having a great time tonight with our special guest, Nassim Haramein, as we talk about the universe and things in space and all these incredible things. Great thought process. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Nassim, if consciousness is a vital part to all of this, that almost tells me that this universe is almost like a living, breathing thing all to itself. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, certainly if you look at our planet, there's a lot of living, breathing things on it. And, you know, we don't really have a theory on how that really fundamentally occurred. And but I'd like to put a little nuances on the statement, because when you say a conscious universe, if you don't define consciousness, it doesn't really tell me anything about the universe neither. And, you know, and because it's like, what is consciousness? How does it occur? What is the functioning of it? And why does it occur? And so this is where my work led me eventually, is to, you know, as I was working the forces of nature, working out how nature produces gravitational fields and electromagnetic fields and so on. And as I wrote papers describing these things, and I figured out some of the topology necessary, that is, with the geometry necessary for this to occur, I realized that there's a fundamental feedback of information between the gravitational field, which is information moving in, and the electromagnetic field, which is information moving out. And when you have a feedback like this, now you have a basis for self-awareness. You know, consciousness is being self-aware. In order to be self-aware, you need feedback. And that just happens to be the fundamental way fractal equations are written. A fractal equation is an equation in which you take the result of it, you feed it back, and you get another iteration, which is take the answer and feed it back, and so on, and you get this infinite amount of complexity out of a very, very, very simple set of rules. And so it's a nice way to start to describe nature, because that's what you see in nature. And you see fractals everywhere in nature. When you look around, for instance, the way the branches of a tree divide, the way the roots of a tree go into the ground, the way your nervous system divides, the way your your veins and arteries, and you can see it everywhere. And so, you know, to me, then it became clear that it must be fundamental to the way the universe functions. And now when you start to think of it that way, now you have the basis, the mechanics of consciousness. And you realize that it's not individualized to a human being, but it is a fundamental functioning of the structure of nature. And then the end result is this human being looking back at itself, going, what am I and what is this universe? Does that make sense?
Yes, and if you can understand that, I think you can use that in your day-to-day living and begin to do some incredible things with this. It's almost like a gift.
That's right. First of all, it takes all away the dogmas, and then you start to realize that you are interacting with the universe. You know, one of the early realization I had, I think I was more in my around 15 or 16 when I realized that the atoms are made out of 99.99999% space. And so I realized that our world is actually, you know, mostly space, and that what we call the real world, like the material world, is actually 0.00001% of what's actually there. And, you know, we always think of the material world defining the space. And I start to reverse that concept and think maybe it's the space that produced the material world. Maybe space is not empty. Maybe space is full. And when it divides itself, when it makes a boundary, we see it as something. We say it's a planet, it's a star, or we say it's an atom or a subatomic particle.
Well, that's that's a good theory on your part, and to me, more scientists need to begin to think that way.
Well, you know, when I looked into it, I found that actually at the atomic level, at the quantum level, when we look at the space there, which is called a vacuum in physics, the vacuum or the space-time manifold at the atomic level is actually not empty. It's full of energy. It's extremely energetic. When the calculation is made, the vacuum fluctuation, that is how much energy is fluctuating in the space-time manifold inside the atom, the density is 10 to the 93rd grams per centimeter cube. 10 to the 93 grams per centimeter cube is extremely large. I'll give you an example. If I took all of the mass of the universe and I squished it into a centimeter cube of space, like I took all the stars and the galaxies, and there's billions of galaxies, there's billions of stars, and I stuck them all into a centimeter cube of space, I would have 10 to the 55th gram per centimeter cube. That would be 39 orders of magnitude less than the density of the vacuum calculated in quantum theory. And we need that number in quantum theory to make everything work. And there's experiments that prove that it is that dense, that it is there, that that energy is in the vacuum. So to think of space, to think of the space between things, or the space in between atoms, or the space inside the atoms as empty, is incorrect. It's actually completely full, and it's just like this. Why can't we experience it then? Well, because if it's everywhere, it all cancels out, and when it cancels out, it appears to us as empty.
When you were a little boy and you were thinking about the dots that the teacher was talking about, and you kept saying, you know, how can this be? I don't think that's the case. I sometimes think about that, Nassim, with the Big Bang theory as well. I have a difficult time comprehending how all of this started from nothing, from some kind of a bang. And we're not talking about a bang of noise. It was almost as if it was illuminated throughout. But I have a difficult time understanding how it started.
That's right. I mean, you know, the Big Bang theory says that all of our universe came out of a dot billions of times smaller than the atom, a Planck's distance size, a little singularity. And that's, you know, and so this is actually one of the hints I got early on that actually, you know, the dot can be divided to infinity, that within a dot can reside a universe. And I realized that maybe every atom is a mini dot like that, a mini singularity, a mini black hole, and that it has infinite amount of division possible within it. And I start to treat it that way. I start to look at the atomic world as all mini singularities produced by the division of the space. And when I calculated it, and, you know, this is the paper I just released. I just presented it at the physics conference in Liège University in Belgium, and it won a Best Paper Award. This paper described the atom as a mini black hole. And when you do that, all of a sudden you can eliminate one of the biggest obstacles to unification of the forces. You can eliminate the strong force. You can, because now you have mini black holes in the nuclei of the atom interacting with each other, and their attraction force is strong enough to hold the atom together. And all of a sudden, you get all the appropriate numbers to describe the nuclei of the atom. That is, the output of the math is what is measured in laboratory, and you've unified the small world with the big world because you've treated the atom as a mini black hole, which uses Einstein's field equations and Newtonian mechanics to describe it. And eventually what happened there is that you fulfilled Einstein's dream that there would be a way to connect the two, that there's a fundamental primal mechanical function to the way the atom works. And then there's a philosophical, amazing thing that happens in these calculations, because when you know, I was saying that the vacuum may not be empty, it's full.
Right.
Well, you know, if you were trying to find something that connects all things, the only thing you could point at is space, because it's everywhere. It's inside the atom, it's everywhere between things. So if the space is full and it's got this amazing energy in it because everything is radiating into it, information, well, when you look at it with these calculations I've made, you find that in the vacuum energy potential inside the proton, inside the nuclei of an atom, is all of the mass of the universe, meaning that the vacuum energy connects all the protons in our universe. That's called entanglement. So that all protons are entangled, all protons are connected. And really, this gives a meaning to the concept that we're all one, that everything is connected, that you can't disconnect anything from anything else in this universe.
What is your take on dark energy, dark matter? Just what is this?
I think that dark energy, dark matter was invented by us because our equations didn't work out.
We created it, huh?
That's right. You know, we've done that in physics a bunch of times. Usually it eventually gets rectified. But, you know, when we ran the equations that we have for the big stuff, and we looked at the way our universe is behaving, we're missing 96 to 98% the mass of the universe.
It doesn't make any sense, does it?
It doesn't, except that in this case, the way we've ran the equation, we've completely avoided or ignored the fact that the vacuum seems to be energetic, that it's not empty, but that it's full. Instead of looking at that, we invented a new kind of matter that doesn't radiate, that's exactly in the right proportion to make our equations work, and dark energy that's not detectable, that's in the exact proportion to make the equation work. So, you know, that way of doing physics, I call it as physics as you go, and I think it demands a deeper look at, and that deeper look is this possibility that there is a connective medium that we call space, and that space is not empty, and in fact, that the material world is made of it. And I'll just give you a simple visualization on that.
Okay, yeah, please.
Imagine that what I'm talking about, the space, is actually water, like an ocean. And there is nowhere where there's no water. So there's nowhere where you can differentiate. But where the water makes a little vortex. So the water in mostly in a pool, for instance, is random, right? It's all the molecules are moving randomly. But if you have a little vortex in the pool, then in that region, the molecules are more organized. They're all spinning in the same direction, and there's much more coherency. Well, when you see that little vortex, if you don't know that it's the water that's doing it, you would say, oh, there's something over there. And in this case, you would call it matter. So what we see in our universe, according to my findings, what we call the material world, that 0.00001 of a percent of the space, is actually just a little vortex of the space. And the rest of the space appears empty to us, so all we see is the little vortex where the space becomes coherent, and it produces a little bit of energy out of it, and we say, oh, there's an atom, or we say, oh, there's a star, oh, there's a galaxy, or here's a universe.
What do you think of Stephen Hawking and some of his views?
Well, Dr. Hawking has done great work throughout the ages, throughout the time, producing very important work to help further physics. He's done a very good job, and as well has done a very good job in making those physics accessible to the public at large.
Yeah.
And so I have great respect for Mr. Hawking. And at the same time, one of the biggest problems with the institutionalized structures and the organizations on our planet is that the tendencies for people to continue to think in the same line of thoughts of their predecessor and the people before them.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually it always leads to the same conclusion. And so it's very hard for them to break through that and actually come up with new ideas that may seem quite radical at the beginning, but may have great value.
Nassim, the Renaissance Project, tell me about this.
The Resonance Project.
Resonance.
Yes, like ringing bells. The Resonance Project is an organization I founded, a nonprofit organization that brings physicists together and scientists from all walks of life, biologists and mathematicians and so on. And we work on unified theories, on furthering unified theories and developing new understanding and bringing them to the public, as well as, you know, working on the applications to these theories to further our world, because, you know, these theories are very interesting and they have great philosophical meaning. I mean, for instance, the idea that you're made of, I mean, think about it, George. Imagine that you start experiencing as yourself as these little mini black holes, vortex of the space.
Yeah.
And you know, because you're made out of billions of these little vortexes. And imagine that you're exchanging information with the vacuum and that, you know, the vacuum is exchanging information back with you by feeding you your reality, which now you interpret and feed back to the vacuum and so on. Well, imagine that you understand the dynamics of this. Really, the root of consciousness becomes available to you. You can actually become a vacuum engineer. I mean, literally, in your own consciousness, in your own feedback, you can start to alter that feedback. Well, there's applications to that in advanced technology and understanding of the laws of nature as well. So, you know, the Resonance Project is part of, you know, developing ideas in engineering for future technologies that could transform our world. If the vacuum has all this energy in it, and if the vacuum is actually coherent in some region that makes up our material world, then there is nothing that stops us from actually making the vacuum a little coherent here or a little coherent there to extract extremely large amount of energy or curve space-time or even warp space-time and travel the universe.
Let's take this break, Nassim, and we'll be right back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Nassim Haramein, so get ready for that. Hey, by the way, you might remember the prison guard Percy Wetmore in the Academy Award-nominated film The Green Mile. Well, on Friday night, on our Coast to Coast program, actor and vampire enthusiast Doug Hutchison, Percy Wetmore, joins us in the studio before open lines. Don't miss it. Let's talk a little bit more about the unification theory, what you've worked on so much in your career. Are there different unification theories, Nassim, or primarily just one?
No, there's multiple unification theory out there right now. Most of them are incomplete. They don't necessarily do the job. They, in some cases, get very close, and in many cases are very, very complex. And so what I'm excited about with this new paper I just published is that it's very simple, and it clarifies the issue very, very rapidly, and it doesn't demand, you know, hundreds of extra dimensions or, you know, some strange strings or anything like that. It actually is very fundamental. It's very based on fundamental mechanics and fundamental physics, and it unifies the fields very nicely.
Now, you talk in your DVD series, Crossing the Event Horizon, about four forces of nature that are effectively unified. Let's go through those four forces. What are they?
So currently there is a gravitational force and an electromagnetic force, okay, right? And there is a strong force at the atomic level and the weak force at the atomic level. And basically what my theory does is that it eliminates the strong force and the weak force and reduces the forces to only two forces, a force that pulls in, gravitation, mm-hmm, and a force that pulls out, electromagnetic fields. And it starts to establish this relationship between the two in terms of a feedback so that, you know, we get this information network that I was describing. And this feedback, you know, this feedback is based on this topology of a torus, which is like a donut. If you can imagine rolling a donut onto itself, like going from the edge of a donut, and if you could roll it towards the middle, towards the hole, then, you know, you would have the bottom part of the donut rolling out and the inner part of the donut rolling in so that you can have expansion and contraction at the same time. So that our universe would be like that, for instance. Instead of the universe just expanding, it would expand and contract at the same time. But because we are very, very small in it, and we can only see a very small portion of it, we see the expansion side because we're most likely in that section of the universe. But at the same time, at the poles of the universe, then there would be stuff going back in. We see that dynamic even at the galactic level, and we see it in the plasma dynamics of our sun. We see it all over the place. So this unification theory actually unifies the fields by basically getting rid of two of the forces, mm-hmm, of the quantum world and replacing them with the forces that were described by Einstein's field equation.
Does string theory fit into any of this?
String theory is a theory that was produced in some ways to avoid singularity, to avoid this point of infinite density that that produces the difficulty in terms of Einstein's equation and in terms of describing the atomic level. In my case, I do the exact contrary. I actually allow the singularity to exist. I allow the nuclei of an atom to become a black hole, because remember, from my first thoughts when I was a kid, was that the center of an atom could get divided and divided and divided to infinity. And actually, you know, we've built accelerators that are larger and larger and larger to break the atom in smaller and smaller and smaller bits. I mean, we're breaking bits like millions and millions of times smaller than the atom now. And every time we have to build larger and larger accelerators, I mean, the one we just built is 17 mile long. It costs some $12 billion to build. And, you know, we're looking for bits that are millions and millions of times smaller than the atom. And my theory says, well, you can always get smaller bits. You can always build a larger accelerator and get smaller and smaller parts. It's not telling you much about the universe. What we should pay attention about is how does the bits get produced? What is the pattern of division? Because the pattern of division from infinitely big to infinitely small would be the key to the structure of space-time, the key to creation. And that's more important than trying to find some God particle that would be the smallest thing the universe does. And then eventually a physicist would write a new equation saying, oh, actually, we could probably divide that into a smaller bit. And so, you know, this is changing this whole view to saying we have infinities, we have mini black holes, and we call them atoms. And then if we treat the atom that way, then all of the math starts to come out to give the right results for the measured values we get in laboratory.
You talked about the God particle, which is what they're going to be looking for when they finally turn on that particle accelerator at CERN, too far from where you were born, I think. What happens? Could they create a black hole there, SM?
The math shows that they would have the energy levels that they could create what they call mini black holes. But, in contrast to what I'm saying, first of all, I don't think there's any reason for alarm there because, in my view, everything is already mini black holes.
No need to head for the hills. There's no place to run anyway.
That's right. But I think that they're going to have surprise. I think they're going to get some really interesting data, and that some of this data is going to confirm a lot of the things I'm predicting. However, I believe that if what I'm saying is eventually understood, that we're going to abandon this idea to keep building larger accelerator. I mean, we have reached practical limits. This accelerator we built, the Hadron Collider, is enormous, is ginormous. I mean, first time they turned it on, it's so strong that it pulled some of the magnets right off their anchor.
Yeah, sure did.
And, and so on. And so, 17 mile long, and so on. I think we're reaching practical limits, and we are reaching the end of this field of investigation at the same time. And so to start understanding what is the pattern of division and how is space dividing, because literally when we're dividing particles, when we're dividing little bits that are billions of times smaller than the atom, we're basically dividing the vacuum. You know, if you wouldn't see those particles, you would think it's the vacuum. You know, these particles are really like, I believe, a function of the vacuum itself, of the space itself. We are living in a sea of energy we call space. And when it self-organizes, it appears to us as particle and matter. And that sea of energy connects all things and self-organizes everything. I think this is what people call God.
Good point.
You know, if you look at all these masters that walked the earth, they all told us that, you know, God is within everything. That it's omnipresent. That if we want to find, people say, I have a hard time visualizing infinity. Well, that's because most people try to visualize infinitely big, and your senses are limited in that way. But if you actually go inwards, and, those infinities occur in all of your atoms, then you have access to that infinity within yourself. And so, you know, it starts to match nicely what has been taught in philosophy and religions all around the world. The idea that within is the kingdom of heaven, or whichever way it was called in many different cultures, you know, the Bindu point, mm-hmm. and so on, and that this information, that you have a link to all there is within yourself, and this vacuum energy, this medium, I believe, is the source of this knowledge, is actually the source of all the material world and reality. Everything emerges from it, and everything returns to it.
Pretty dramatic stuff. So when do you win the Nobel Prize in science?
It'll happen
eventually.
Well, one can hope. However, you know, I really don't do this for prizes, but if a prize will make this work more accessible to the people, and
it makes the world wake up, and they will hear this, see this, but if you get awarded this honor, then all of a sudden it puts you on the map, even bigger than you already are.
Thank you, I appreciate, and I really think that this. That we are undergoing this transformation in our science, and that it's going to transform our world so rapidly. You know, it's like if you went to the little lake or the beach where the Wright brothers flew the first plane, and you went there like a week before, and you told people, you know, in a week, two brothers are going to come here, and they're going to lift a few thousand pounds of material off the ground,
and fly like a bird.
And fly like a bird. They would have said, "You're completely insane," but a week later it was done. And you know, I think we're right at that turning point where what we can barely imagine what's coming around the corner, because as soon as this understanding is clear, as soon as this unification is done, our understanding of the universe is going to change. Our understanding of ourself in the universe is going to change. I mean, fundamentally, even philosophically, like realizing that we're never separate from anything, and that, you know, that we are going around on our planet going, well, you know, there's just not enough space and enough energy for everybody. And to transforming that to this, oh my God, there's infinite amount of energy, and there's infinite amount of space to go and explore. Because if you have access to that energy, all of a sudden, gravitational drives and all these things become possible. So our civilization is just about to turn the corner, and I think we're at this choosing time right now.
Prior to the Big Bang, in your opinion, what was there before it started? Try to paint me a picture of this.
Right. Well, you know, that's the thing. In this view, there was never a beginning. There was never an end. You know, if there's infinite amount of divisions from infinitely big to infinitely small, all there is cycles. And so, you know, instead of one big bang, there is infinite amount of bangs, you know, and so it's a continuous creation process, that there's continuous creation occurring at the center of, supermassive black holes, at the center of galaxies, that they're producing mini black holes we call atoms and so on, so that the universe is actually continuously producing universes and multiverses and so on. And it's because our lifetime and our evolution is so short relative to, you know, cosmological time, we've only observed one bang, and we call it the Big Bang because it's the one we came out of. But that this is occurring all the time, and that it is a continuous creation process, and we are part of this creation. We're part of the information network that produces all that we see, and we can't separate ourselves from it.
When I was a kid, I asked my mother, what was God, Nassim, and she said, always was, always will be. Almost like you just said what the universe is.
Right. Right. I think, you know, when you start to look at these physics, the way I'm describing them, I'm sorry.
Sure.
And
I've got you talking for 3 hours, so I'm pushing you. Huh? This is longer than some of your lectures, isn't it?
Yeah, some of them. And I'm known for 13 hours lectures as well.
Good.
But, you know, these cultures all around the world, that's what's remarkable, is when you study all their description of what they may call God or the Creator and so on, they all kind of come together in some ways. They talk about this omnipresence. They talk about this infinite potential and so on, this self-organizing system and so on. And when you look at this theory and you start to understand the way the universe, the way it describes it, it actually is very similar, but it gives fundamental mechanics and fundamental physics on how this actually happened. Like people saying, it's all one, you know. Well, you know, how is it all one? Well, there's physics that makes that possible and so on. And so, you know, when you understand the fundamentals of how that's true, then all of a sudden the dogma is lifted, and now you're starting to understand the universe for its fundamental physics and its fundamental creation power. And as you understand them, you can start to play with them. You can start to interact with them in a better way, so you're more harmonious with them. And as well, so that you have all the resources you need, because creation is quite resourceful.
It's exciting to think about the possibilities of all of this, isn't it? My gosh.
Oh, it is. It's amazing, because you can see our civilization taking a giant leap in its evolution as it discovers these principles. Because basically, you know, if you fundamentally understand the principles that produces our universe, then you can, you know, bootstrap yourself to it, and the possibilities are, you know, infinite. The possibilities are beyond what we can imagine today in terms of health, transportation, and so on. And I think our civilization is prime for that change.
I think so too. Tell me a little bit about how you can get this DVD, Crossing the Event Horizon.
It is available on our website. And, you know, theresonanceproject.org, and people can buy it online there. It's a 4-DVD set. It's over 8 hours of information, including the special features. And it encompasses from the science and the philosophy to ancient civilization, and many examples of the monuments and texts around the world that describe this information. And it has all sorts of interesting bonus features and interviews with my co-author, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. And
there are 4 CDs, right? 4 DVDs.
There's 4 DVDs, and so it's packed with information, and it's a very in-depth view of the whole picture.
Very good. Well, stay with us. We're going to have a final hour to go with you, and we'll take phone calls coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, George at Coast2TO, coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment with phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.